following program is brought to you by Susty Party, an online party supply store for eco-friendly party products and biodegradable compostable tableware. For more information, visit sustyparty.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 49. I'm your host, Jesse Kiefer.
And I'm Jen Tellek.
In studio today, Marcy Frankowiak, bartender at St. Maisie in Williamsburg. She was selected as one of the New York Times Women Behind Bars. Congratulations on that, Marcy.
Thank you.
And she's also a badass mural painter. We'll talk to her a little later in the show about bartending at St. Maisie and why it even matters to be a female bartender, why that topic is even
around. Why does
around.
It matter?
I'm not I entirely wonder. Sure, but we're going to get down to it. And speaking of behind bars, after the break, the morning after takes a dark turn. We'll hear from Arizona Republic reporter Michael Kiefer, and no, the last name is no coincidence. He is my father. He covers courts and crime in Phoenix, Arizona, and with that beat comes witnessing executions. So we'll talk to him about death row inmate last meals.
And later we will revisit our favorite two standbys, the now legendary sequence known as front of house, where we highlight terrible mishaps from the front of house service industry, and also what's on the menu at Chardonnay's, our mystical 90s restaurant featuring terrible food and wine trends of days gone by. But first, before we go to a break, a good friend of the show's is in the house tonight talking, or by really this afternoon.
It's the morning after.
I'm ready for it to be evening.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge time frame.
I'm wearing enough eye makeup for it to be evening, so it was confusing. A good friend of mine and a coworker, Andrew Halden from Highlands Restaurant Group, is with us tonight to talk about a really cool event that he is doing this evening. Mr. Halden, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, America.
Straight from London.
The accent is no joke.
I've been lucky enough to work with this fine gentleman for a couple of years now. And Andrew, in addition to being a kick-ass bartender and dapper gentleman, is hosting a really cool event at my place of work. Andrew, tell us about your quiz night.
So it's a trivia night on Sunday evenings. That's this evening. It runs from 7 till 9 p.m. There are food availabilities beforehand and drink availabilities throughout. The trivia is fun, with an emphasis on fun. It's going to be a good time, basically. I write the questions. Can I give you an example, maybe?
Please, please, quiz us.
Some are very subjective, of course, but the bigger the imagination, the bigger the point scoring. One of the questions last week was, if The Rock was actually a rock, what stone would he be, and what formation would he be found in?
May I share the answer I gave you while working?
Please, Jen, do.
Andrew and I were working a particularly slow shift, and to pass the time...
Dead.
Tumbleweeds. Andrew gave me the quiz, and I believe my answer was a slab of faux granite on the kitchen floor of Lindsay Lohan's mansion.
3 points. That's top score.
And this is what we're talking about with being subjective. If you don't have an imagination and are yet talented at stenography, you still have an opportunity to win, because there are questions that are straight up trivia, like
Can I give my rock? I mean, I was thinking of it rather literally. I was going to call him like lava, hardened lava, magma, volcanic.
That's good.
We did have a lava, actually. We also had pebble, because deep inside he's quite soft and small. The pebble rock. There's other things so the first round is always New York this week. So it's 10 questions about what happened in New York this week. Some are pretty random, which have multiple choice answers. The second is also always Musica y Filma. That is Spanish for music and film.
Is it?
I'm sorry if that's not
learning
Spanish.
Learning Spanish while having fun.
It's English Spanish. And then the third and fourth round rotate. We do charades, spot the difference. All mature things, basically, that adults should do.
Let me ask you this. Are the winners rewarded in any way?
That's correct. They are. Thank you, Jen, for asking that.
You're welcome.
They... So at the moment we're just getting on our feet, and there's champagne prizes for the ultimate winner. And then each round I have a clear bottle of liquid with a bit of masking tape on it, which has the word booze, and it's the booze bowl. And the booze bowl is poured out to any imaginative and creative people, and people that make other people laugh.
So there's multiple opportunities to drink.
Basically, yeah.
Is what you're telling me.
On a serious note, no hecklers. We did have someone that had to be ejected. They were dejected after they were ejected.
It ejects them right into Rosemary's.
That's right, yeah.
Right in the middle of Rosemary's.
There is a slight serious side to it, because obviously, you know, it's a competitive sport, I believe. Trivia. We call it quiz in the UK. And so there's prizes to be won. It's actually going to be going in the Time Out magazine on the calendar the week after next.
Fantastic.
So it's going to get pretty busy. Come in, make a team, no bigger than four. And in 2 weeks' time, we're going to start a 12-week cycle, and at the end of that, there'll be a big prize.
Do people ever get in like physical altercations about this? I mean,
not yet, but I hope so.
Well, I'm coming tonight, and I plan on getting a little rowdy, so watch out. I'm small but mighty. So to recap, Andrew, for those of you listening who are obviously interested, this is at Highlands Restaurant, which is at?
Highlands Restaurant is on the corner of West 10th and Waverly Place in the West Village of Manhattan. And
which is Spanish for Manhattan.
Manhattan, that's right. And it is on 150 West 10th Street.
You can take the one train to Christopher.
One train to Christopher, or you can take the
ACE to West 4th.
That's correct, yeah. Or you can take the train to Columbus Circle and just walk like 50 blocks.
Or if you have
south.
A pack mule, donkey, or quarter horse, you can just hop on that and take it at your leisure. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for stopping by.
Jen, thank you. Jess, thank you. Marcy, thank you. And thank you, America.
I will see you in T-minus 4 hours. And let me tell you, I got my game-playing hat on.
Let's play quiz.
The morning after here on Heritage Radio Network. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Onions Milk by EGG.
And I'm Jessica Holsey.
We are the entrepreneurs behind Susty Party. Susty Party creates responsibly made, eco-friendly party supplies and compostable tableware. Parties and events generate the second largest amount of waste in the USA, just behind the construction industry. Susty Party products make parties more sustainable and sustainability a little more fun.
Susty Party plates, bowls, and straws are available in Whole Foods retail stores and also at sustyparty.com. We offer a curated selection of other Susty-approved party supplies. We also have a commercial division, Sustyware, that sells compostable tableware in bulk to businesses and food service industry establishments.
Susty Party is a certified youth trade company and B Corporation. Our social, economic, environmental, and even spiritual values drive Susty Party to live our motto,
Respect Earth and Party On.
Welcome back to The Morning After on Heritage Radio Network. In studio, Michael Kiefer, reporter for the Arizona Republic and author of 3 novels and 1 nonfiction book. And the last name is no coincidence. He is my father. So 2 Kiefers, 1 studio. Hey, Anna. Dad. Welcome. Now, in Arizona, in the Arizona Republic, you cover courts and crime, and with that comes witnessing executions, correct?
Right. I pretty much cover the gamut of death penalties from when they're from the trial and then through to the execution.
And so how many executions have you witnessed?
I've witnessed four. I've covered 10, and I don't know how many cases I've covered that have ended in death penalties.
And, you know, one of the, I just find kind of strangest announcements that they do after executions is talk about the last meal. And I know often, you know, people will joke about, oh, you know, what would my last meal be? But it's a real thing, and people get pretty specific.
Absolutely. It's executions are, it's strange to say, but they're almost ritualistic. And I once heard a prosecutor say that he thought that they staged them that way to try to convince themselves that this was not a violent act. But part of the ritual, and editors love the last meal, is this announcement of what their last meal was. Usually after the execution's over, they gather the media. The witnesses then address the media. But before that, they give the time of death, and they very, very formally and seriously announce what the last meal was.
So is there, for the inmate, is there a protocol that they follow as far as what they're going to order for their last meal?
Well, there's a menu. There's a lot of things they can choose from, but not an absolute open book. You know, you can't get a six pack.
Unfortunately, probably exactly what they need at that moment.
Exactly.
That would be my last meal. So in talking about how specific they can get, what are some of the last meals that you've witnessed? Maybe one that gets really, really specific.
Well, Eric King was executed in 2011. He had killed two security guards during a robbery of a Phoenix convenience store. And his last meal, as they read it, was 6 ounces of fried catfish, 1/2 cup collard greens, 1/2 cup candied yams, 2 small portions of cornbread, 1 small tomato, 1 medium pink grapefruit, 1 wedge of chocolate cake, and 2 20-ounce bottles of cream soda.
It almost, in the beginning, kind of sounds like a very specific diet, you know,
where
you have a recipe, like something that you have to measure out. Now, as far as the last meal, like, why should it matter to an inmate? They're just going to be, they're going to be passing away the next morning.
Well, I know one of the executions I covered, the condemned man chose not to have a last meal, afraid to be sick. Others enjoy it. I remember a guy named Robert Tower. He was executed earlier this year. He had a steak and baked potato and mushrooms, asparagus. You know, the only thing missing was a nice Cabernet. But he really enjoyed it. He kept a diary of his last days. And one of the things that really struck me, and it's kind of sad, heart-wrenching, was that the next morning they gave him like a glass of orange juice. And he wrote down in this diary that he sent to his attorney, it's the first time I've had orange juice in 20 years, and I can't believe how good it tastes.
I feel like I never would imagine what it would feel like to not have something for so long, and then the moment before you pass, like, you end up having.
Well, and there was another guy who, at his clemency hearing, which was his last hearing before he was executed, wanted to save the bottle of water they gave him because he wanted to mix Kool-Aid in it because the water in prison was so bad, and he was excited about the fact that he could have Kool-Aid that tasted good.
Now, I mean, I'm sure prison food isn't on the top of, you know, gourmet lists, but in Arizona, it is kind of a... Is this true with Joe Arpaio in the jails, that he is specifically making sure that they are having a kind of lousy meal? Or is that just my opinion?
Well, green bologna, that's a whole... I mean, jail and prison are two different things, but...
Oh, sure.
I don't know what they eat on a regular basis. I assume the last meal is a little step up from their ordinary
fare. I mean, so does each prison have a chef? Are they going out to find these things? Do you think they go to, you know, they get delivered? What do you think they do?
I have no idea.
Because, I mean, you know, they have all these cakes, they have all these different sodas. I think we were talking about one of them got Royal Crown Cola or something like that. And I don't even think I ever saw that growing up in Arizona.
Oh, right. That was
like
Bobby
RC.
Bobby Moorman, who was already in prison, and he had a family visit with his mother at a local motel, and she was also his lover. And she he strangled her and then cut her up into little pieces. And anyway, yes, he had very specifically the Royal Crown Cola. Along with the hamburger fries, two beef burritos, and Rocky Road ice cream.
Now, I wonder if, I mean, they can't always finish all of this, right? I mean, I would imagine with ordering such an abundance of food like that, you're not going to be able to take all that down in one meal.
Well, they don't tell us how, you know, how much of it they ate, but there used to be a whole lot of fried okra. That was a popular one.
Really?
Fried okra. Right. Well, you know, it's Southern boys.
Got it. Wasn't there one guy who actually couldn't finish all of his food? And
well, it wasn't that he, this was a few years ago, it wasn't that he couldn't finish. He was a little out of touch with reality. He had a piece of cake, which he wrapped up, and when they asked him why he was wrapping up the piece of cake, he said he was going to save it for tomorrow.
That's pretty dark.
Yes.
Do you think he actually believed it?
Possibly.
And Dad, thank you so much for being here with me. It's been an honor to have you on The Morning After.
Thank you, Jess, for inviting me. I hope I didn't scandalize your listeners.
No, I think you know, the last meal is an interesting topic, and it's certainly something that I've thought about. Not that I'm going to commit any crime where I would have to have a last meal, but do you have any ideas of what your last meal would be? Let's not think death row. Just let's think last meal, everything you could have.
I think I'm going for that steak with mushrooms and asparagus and baked potato like Robert Towery, except I'm hoping I get the nice red wine with mine.
Sounds good. And where can, if anyone wants to check out your books or to read any of your articles on The Republic, where can we send listeners to?
Well, azcentral.com is the Arizona Republic. My books are available as ebooks and paperbacks on Amazon and other places. And actually, that diary I mentioned, Robert Towery, is available also as an ebook on Amazon.com. It's called Death House Diary, and it's fascinating reading.
Well, thank you so much. We'll be back on The Morning After on Heritage Radio Network.
And we're back here in The Morning After on Heritage Radio Network. Here in studio with us today is a good friend of mine and a badass lady, Marcin Frankowiak, bartender at St. Maisie's and recently featured in New York Magazine's, or New York Times magazines. It was in the paper and the magazine, right? I think it was. It was everywhere. Women Behind Bars feature. So cool. Congrats, first of all.
Thank you.
On the press. It's awesome. So I imagine that was a fun group of gals to do a shoot with.
Amazing.
Yeah?
Amazing. Because all of us have never like done something like that before. And we just walked in thinking that, oh, they're just going to take our picture and we're going to leave. It was like this huge building. Like all these like models were kind of walking around, you know, like drinking their Diet Cokes. We were like hauling on sandwiches and like drinking buds.
As you should.
Yeah. And we were just like cracking up the entire time. But it was a 4-hour photo shoot.
Now, how many of you were featured?
Seven. Most of the other chicks were like super badass. Like they were from mostly Park Slope areas. Some also part owners as well. But all of them are just super cool. So
now, how did they find you? Who contacted you, and how did that happen?
I think one of the owners of St. Maisie is Johnny McCormick, that owns Moto as well. And he just called me up and said, "Oh, some lady from the New York Times is going to contact you." And I was like, "Whatever, cool, into it." So
amazing. Now, I've had the privilege of working with you before, and you're an amazing bartender. But you also do some really cool other stuff, which is a theme on the show. We often talk to people who are working in the industry and also doing other stuff to subsidize, or vice versa. And you're a pretty badass painter.
Shucks.
Oh, I've seen I've seen your stuff. It's amazing. And recently you've been specifically focusing on doing murals. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, basically it's that whole aspect of manual labor and painting,
mm-hmm.
which is like my perfect combination of doing anything. So, yeah, cause I moved to Philadelphia in February for only 3 months. Doing the mural training program with the Philadelphia Mural Organization, and moved back right after it was done, and I'm just getting a bunch of walls that I keep doing.
How does that work, a mural training program? So you show up and you have your little lunch pail and your paints,
yeah,
and they say,
yeah, and you have like sit in class for a few hours and they yell at you a lot. No, just basically about learning like what kind of hoops you have to go through, like, you know, community meetings, what type of wall it is, like how, like if the wall is actually being able to paint on, like what kind of paint to use. And also just like doing things like, okay, like from the one I did on Myrtle Broadway, I learned right away, like I painted a rooster, but I kind of just painted it freehand and didn't really use photo references, and mad haters mean that the rooster doesn't look right, blah, blah, blah. Like, just to where the point is, like, I had to go back and just fix it, like, full on.
You got mural haters.
Mural haters about a rooster.
Because there are a lot of roosters in Brooklyn, so.
Yeah.
People want them represented correctly.
What did it look like? Was it, like, more, like cartoon-like, or
no,
was it
it's
very
just,
realistic?
It was realistic, but the beak was too high. So I wanted the rooster to be looking up. However, everybody was like, nah. No way. Change it. And I was like,
this rooster ain't right.
Yeah, it was like, dance, puppets, dance. Like, I had to get back on that wall and just, like, fix it. And it's, like, instantly, like, a million homies come up and they're like, all right.
This is better.
All right, this is a better rooster.
Yeah, that's a rooster. Like, I was like, cool.
What's the biggest scale mural you've ever done?
Probably, I would say about 60 feet by 40 feet.
That's huge.
Yeah, it's awesome.
What was it of?
Basically, it was of, what is it? How am I forgetting this? I did the one in Baltimore, a gristmill, which is basically a water wheel. I basically did a huge gristmill in Remington in Baltimore, just because that whole area used to be just gristmills. So the cool thing about doing murals, which besides doing your art's kind of like more about you and your perspective. Doing murals has nothing to do with you. It's about that community and like what they're about,
right,
and like sort of going along with that community.
That's so cool. Which, I mean, obviously the parallels between bartending and,
oh, completely,
and that are totally obvious.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to be innovative. You have to be ballsy. You have to be strong. Physically strong.
But you gotta
and
make
you
people
have to
happy.
Know the neighborhood.
Yeah, exactly. And you gotta make people happy.
Yeah, make people happy, man.
So you did this shoot. People are buzzing about it. It's so cool. And it's called... I gotta go here. It's called Women Behind Bars.
I hate this title. Like, it's
so now, in theory, it's so cool, and I couldn't be prouder of you or less surprised that you were included in the bunch. But like, why? I mean, we asked the question before. Why women? I feel like bartending
and
above even honestly more than chefing. I feel like bartending is the one aspect of our industry that is gender polarized the most.
Oh, completely.
I mean, I have worked at places that straight up said, we will not hire female bartenders.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't matter how good they are. It doesn't matter why. Why? Like, I don't...
I mean, my thing, I think that it's just one of the things is like, oh, you know, they don't want to leave them alone in the bar. Like, what if something happens? Like, you know, all that kind of, like, you know, whatever. But I mean, I guess, because there are definitely those certain instances where, you know, like some girls at clubs that work at clubs or work at other bars, like honestly, like they're real pretty, you know what I'm saying? But it doesn't necessarily make them a good bartender, which most girls were known to get hired because of, you know, good looks or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think all these chicks that were on me, like on the photo shoot with me, they were just all like running it, like,
yeah,
not taking any.
Well, you don't work in that world, though. I mean, you work in the incredibly heady, competitive world of mixologists. I mean, you guys, there's no way you could get by in that. And for those of you who can't see Marcy, she's also a very pretty girl. But like, that doesn't have anything to do with it. I mean, obviously, you're getting hired for your skill and your.
But it's just like knowing what you're doing, also too, like not complaining, like, and just do your job. Like, put your head down and do your job. You know. So I think, I mean, I don't know. It's just, it's interesting to me that. Because like, it's not like they're doing like dudes behind bars.
Well, of course, because that's everyone else.
You know, bartenders. People.
Yeah, just
featured bartenders.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I remember you telling me some stories when you were in Baltimore about you standing up for yourself. I would never worry about you being alone in a bar because this woman, this amazing tattooed bartender woman, would not take anything from anyone.
Nope.
So tell me about where you're working right now and what that place is like.
St. Maisie. It's on Grand Street in between Havermeyer and Marcy. Said one of the owners, Johnny, also owns Moto. It's very, very beautiful. It's just the whole aesthetic is amazing. Extremely nice food, just like full on, you know, short ribs, chicken, mussels, you know, charcuterie, stuff like that. Really, really amazing liquor selection, huge beer selection. Lots of bands play also too.
Great.
Like last night, this chick, Diva Malone played, like sounds like Etta James, but times three, like super awesome. On Sundays they have Baby Soda, which is sort of like a New Orleans style jazz band. A bunch of swing dancers show up and get crazy. On Fridays we have flamenco. So Spanish flamenco. So that kind of rocks it out. Great backyard. It's pretty good. Right now we're open from like 6 until about 4 in the morning.
6 to 4? What's your favorite drink you're slinging right now?
Oh, favorite drink. I would say it's this sort of twist on an old fashioned, which is equal parts of Applejack with a little maple syrup and orange and Angostura bitters.
Very autumnal.
Yeah, I was going to say, exactly. It sounds like a perfect fall cocktail.
I want to drink that while wearing a sweater and a little scarf. Which I am right now.
Done.
Perfect. Well, when can we find you there?
I'm there every Saturday.
Every Saturday.
Every Saturday.
Marcine Prankowiak, man, you are a badass and a half.
And we're gonna ask her about a perfect cocktail for the Chardonnays.
Oh,
menu.
I got it.
Yes, we are. So when we get back, we're gonna take a quick break. When we come back, we're gonna revisit front of house as well as what's on the menu at Chardonnays here on The Morning After on Heritage Radio. And we're back here in the morning after on Heritage Radio Network. Ladies and gentlemen, it's that time in the program where we revisit the terrible mishaps and wanderings of the front of house. Today's segment is brought to you by a very talented writer and comedian actress that I happen to be working with right now, a woman by the name of Hannah Pearl Utt, an awesome gal. She submitted this story to us yesterday, and it goes a little something like this.
Will we be inviting the dame?
I think I'm just going to read it.
All right.
I'm going to leave the dame out of this one. It's so good on its own. I feel like it would be too much that my head would explode. After being warned that the Nolita hotspot I was working at was about to undergo an ethnic cleansing, it's true, girls without accents just didn't make sense there. I preemptively quit and found myself wandering around a less chic but just as hip neighborhood looking for employment. Fall semester was coming, and my rash transfer was costing me twice as much in tuition and living expenses than in my previous 2 years of college. Finding a job that day was non-negotiable, and I told myself I would take anything. When I finally walked into Restaurant X with the tentative, smiley yet focused air of someone who is about to ask if they can borrow something, I was surprised by the warmth of the man who greeted me, and my question sounded less desperate with this bald-headed Mark Ruffalo on the receiving end. "Hi, are you guys hiring?" Yes, they were, he thought. They just hired someone, but he didn't think she was working out. He personally didn't like her and would put in a good word for me. "I'll give your resume to Stalin." "Pardon?" "Stalin, the manager." "Of course, Stalin, the manager." I received a call from Stalin a few hours later, asking if I could start the next day. I would have to trail the woman whose job I would be taking, and after that, he would get rid of her. "But please, I can't tell her until after weekend. She has to work the weekend." Stalin seemed like a fair and benevolent leader. "Great, sounds great. I'll see you tomorrow at 9. I arrived at Restaurant X at 9 a.m. on the dot, wearing an outfit that said, "I'm taking this seriously, but I have a life." Nice, but not trying too hard. Just like the restaurant. Just like the neighborhood. At around 9:15, I had a dishwasher let me in. I sat and waited until 9:30, when I decided to start taking down chairs and setting up tables. The hours were written on the door. I wasn't mistaken. The restaurant was due to open at 10. After doing everything I could to set up, having only been in there once, I sat back down and opened up my book. At 9:45, a mousy, nervous little twig of a woman walked in, threw her bag on a chair, and went to wash her hands. "Hi," I said, realizing she wasn't going to notice me on her own. "Oh my God, you scared the crap out of me," she squealed with a big New Jersey accent that made no sense coming out of her Midwestern face. "We don't open until 10. "Yeah, Stalin told me to come at 9. "Oh, because we don't open until 10. I understood her confusion. She thought I was a guest. A guest who had somehow let herself in an hour before opening, set everything up, and sat down to wait for a server. "I'm training," I said. "Oh, weird. I wonder who quit." The first couple of hours of service went by smoothly, but Susan was beginning to grow on me, and knowing that I was there to take her job when she thought she was gaining a friend made it hard for me to enjoy the conversation. It didn't help that the two main things she wanted to talk about were her son and the feeling she'd woken up with that morning that something really terrible was going to happen. At around noon, things started to pick up, and the tiny restaurant was flooded by a stream of attractive weekenders with wicked hangovers and cool hair. Susan was a terrible server and didn't manage her stress very well. At the height of the brunch rush, she disappeared for 20 minutes to take a phone call from Stalin. I didn't know where she'd gone until a guest informed me that there was a woman screaming and crying in the back garden, and just thought I should know. Susan reappeared, apologetic and tear-stained, and was back on the floor for no more than 30 minutes before she excused herself again to throw up, casually explaining, "I think I'm having a panic attack." At around 3 o'clock, having made it through waiting on a busy restaurant I'd never worked in before, by myself on a Sunday brunch, I sat down to enjoy a little napkin folding and a beer. Susan joined me at the bar and thanked me for covering for her. I told guests to try the bathroom next door. That heaving sound our toilet is making is broken. I asked if she had a cigarette. She perked up and gave me a conspiratorial nudge. "A drinker and a smoker. I didn't think you were the type." "Oh, I'm not," I said, and then made a lame joke I'd never made before that rarely goes over well. "But I could really go for some heroin," I said. "Really?" she said, suddenly very engaged. No, of course not." She slumped back in her chair, disappointed, and sighed. "Yeah, I started doing it to come down from coke, but now I'm hooked." She laughed at herself, genuinely amused, and pulled out a little baggie of something white and powdery. She shook it a couple of times, lovingly, and said, "That's my baby," and disappeared back into the bathroom. When Stalin questioned me about why I wouldn't be staying at Restaurant X, I told him I'd found another gig, but that I thought he was wrong about Susan. I resumed my job hunt the next day with a newfound confidence and gratitude. And as I withdrew my last $40 to print more resumes and feed my artisanal coffee addiction, the thought that it could always be worse resonated with me in a new way. That's a story by Hannah Protlot here on The Morning After on Heritage Radio Network.
What a nightmare.
That's my baby.
We don't open until 10 o'clock.
Hannah told me this story. I was over at her apartment, and we were talking and eating a salad, and I said, oh, you know, I'm doing this segment on the radio show I'm working on, and she said, oh, I have a couple of stories, and proceeded to not only tell me the story but act it out in full charade in her kitchen, and I was on the floor, and I said, please email that to me because it's perfect. Speaking,
I think Susan would work at Chardonnay's.
I think Susan does work at Chardonnay's. She's the floor manager.
Yes,
speaking of which, Jesse, what is on the menu at Chardonnay's this week?
I'm hoping that Marcy's going to tell us. It's cocktail time at Chardonnay's.
It is. It's cocktail hour. It's happy hour at Chardonnay's, and your head bartender, Marcy.
Happy hour at Chardonnay's.
Yes.
Mid-90s, you're thinking?
Yep.
It's like a plastic, you know,
laminated
menu, like a
menu.
Picture frame or something.
Oh, great.
The glasses have light-up bottoms, and they're called things like the hurricane, the storm.
There might be flames.
Well, you have to name this one.
Okay.
So
you give me the recipe, and then I'll name it.
All right. So we have 1.5-ounce Hennessy.
It's already great.
Okay.
Susan loves it.
2 ounces coconut Ciroc. Diddy.
Yes. Shout out.
Shake it. Top with a little alizé. Gold tooth served in a Honda Civic with the head beam, high beams on.
I am
in light
of our very serious interview earlier, I'm going to call this out on bail.
Done.
Ladies and gentlemen, on the menu at Chardonnay's this evening is the out on bail requested. It is slightly, it's $2 more, and it's an upcharge if you get whipped cream.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What's on the menu with Chardonnay's?
On that note, thanks everyone for tuning in. This is The Morning After on Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.